Chapter 10. A Village in Shiota. The following day brought a respite, or so it seemed. Tuon, in a blue silk riding dress and her wide tooled leather belt, not only rode beside him as the show rolled slowly north, she waggled her fingers at Seleucia when the woman tried to put her dun between them. Seleucia had acquired her own mount somehow, a compact gelding that could not match Pip's or Achaean, but still surpassed the Dapple by a fair margin. The blue-eyed woman, with a green headscarf beneath her cowl today, fell in on Tuon's other side, and her face would have done an Aes Sedai proud when it came to giving nothing away. Matt could not help grinning. Let her hide frustration for a change. Lacking horses, the real Aes Sedai were confined to their wagon. Metwin was too far away on the driver's seat of the purple wagon to overhear what he said to Tuon. Only a few thin clouds remained in the sky from the night's rain, and all seemed right in the world. Even the dice bouncing in his head could steal nothing from that. Well, there were bad moments, but only moments. Early on, a flight of ravens winged overhead, a dozen or more big black birds. They flew swiftly, never deviating from their line, but he eyed them anyway until they dwindled to specks and vanished. Nothing to spoil the day there, not for him at least, maybe for someone farther north.
"Did you see some omen in them, Toy?"
Tuon asked. She was as graceful in the saddle as she was in everything else she did. He could not recall seeing her be awkward about anything.
"Most omens I know concerning ravens specifically have to do with them perching on someone's rooftop or cawing at dawn or dusk."
"They can be spies for the Dark One," he told her. "Sometimes. Crows, too. And rats. But they didn't stop to look at us, so we don't need to worry." Running a green-gloved hand across the top of her head, she sighed.
"Toy, Toy," she murmured, resettling the cowl of her cloak. "How many children's tales do you believe? Do you believe that if you sleep on old Hobbs Hill under a full moon, the foxes will give you true answers to three questions, or that snakes steal people's skins and take the nourishment from food so you can starve to death while eating your fill?"
Putting on a smile took effort.
"I don't think I ever heard either one of those."
Making his voice amused required effort, too. What were the odds of her mentioning foxes giving true answers, which the eelfin did after a fashion, in the same breath with snakes stealing skins? He was pretty sure that the eelfin did, and made leather from it. But it was old Hob that nearly made him flinch. The other was likely just Treviren twisting at the world. She certainly knew nothing about him and the snakes or the foxes. In Shundala, the land where Arthur Hawkwing had been born, though, old Hob, Kaizen Hob, had been another name for the Dark One. The Aelfin and the Eelfin both surely deserved to be connected to the Dark One, yet that was hardly anything he wanted to think on when he had his own connection to the bloody foxes. And to the snakes, too? That possibility was enough to sour his stomach. Still, it was a pleasant ride, with the day warming as the sun rose, though it never could be called warm. He juggled six colored wooden balls, and Tuon laughed and clapped her hands as well she should. That feat had impressed the juggler he bought the balls from, and it was harder while riding. He told several jokes that made her laugh, and one that made her roll her eyes and exchange finger twitchings with Seleucia. Maybe she did not like jokes about common room serving maids. It had not been the least off color. He was no fool. He did wish she laughed, though. She had a marvelous laugh, rich and warm and free. They talked of horses and argued over training methods with stubborn animals. That pretty head held a few odd notions, such as that you could calm a fractious horse by biting its ear. That sounded more likely to send it up like a haystack fire. And she had never heard of humming under your breath to soothe a horse, and would not believe his father had taught him such a skill shy of demonstration. "Well, I can hardly do that without a horse that needs soothing, can I?" he said. She rolled her eyes again. Seleucia rolled hers, too. There was no heat in the argument, though, no anger, just spirit. Tuon had so much spirit it seemed impossible it could fit into such a tiny woman. It was her silences that put a small damper on the day,
more so than snakes or foxes. They were far away, and there was nothing to be done. She was right there beside him, and he had a great deal to do concerning her. She never alluded to what had happened with the Three Aes Sedai or to the sisters themselves, either. She never mentioned his Tir Angreal or the fact that whatever she had made Teslin or Jolene weave against him had failed. The night before might as well have been a dream. She was like a general planning a battle, Satala had said. Trained at intrigue and dissembling from infancy, according to Aginan. And it was all aimed straight at him. But to what end? Surely it could not be some Shonshan blood form of courting. Aginan knew little of that, but surely not. He had known Tuon a matter of weeks, and kidnapped her. She called him Toy, had tried to buy him, and only a vain fool could twist that into a woman falling in love.
Which left anything from some elaborate scheme for revenge to the light alone knew what.
She had threatened to make him a cupbearer. That meant Dacovale, according to Aginan, though she had scoffed at the notion. Cupbearers were chosen for their beauty, and in Aginan's estimation, he fell far short. Well, in his own as well, truth to tell, not that he was likely to admit it to anybody. Any number of women had admired his face. Nothing said Tuon could not complete the marriage ceremony just to make him think himself home free and safe, then have him executed. Women were never simple, but Tuon made the rest look like children's games. For a long while they saw not so much as a farm, but perhaps 2 hours after the sun passed its zenith they came on a sizable village. The ring of a blacksmith's hammer on an anvil sounded dimly. The buildings, some of 3 stories, were all heavy timber framing with whitish plaster between, and had high-peaked roofs of thatch and tall stone chimneys. Something about them tugged at Matt's memory, but he could not say what. There was not a farm to be seen anywhere in the unbroken forest. But villages were always tied to farms, supporting them and living off them. They must all be further in from the road, back in the trees. Oddly, the people he could see ignored the approaching train of show wagons. A fellow in his shirt sleeves, right beside the road, glanced up from the hatchet he was sharpening on a grindstone, worked by a foot pedal, then bent to his work again as though he had seen nothing. A cluster of children came hurtling around a corner and darted into another street without more than a glance in the show's direction. Very odd. Most village children would stop to stare at a passing merchant's train, speculating on the strange places the merchant had been, and the show had more wagons than any number of merchant's trains. A peddler was coming from the north behind 6 horses, his wagon's high canvas cover almost hidden by clusters of pots and pans and kettles. That should have caused interest, too. Even a large village on a well-traveled road depended on peddlers for most things the people bought. But no one pointed or shouted that a peddler had come. They just went on about their business. Perhaps 300 paces short of the village, Luca stood up on his driver's seat and looked back over the roof of his wagon.
"We'll turn in here,"
he bellowed, gesturing toward a large meadow where wildflowers, cat daisies, and jump-ups, and something that might have been lover's knots, dotted spring grasses already a foot high. Sitting back down, he suited his own words, and the other wagons began following, their wheels rutting the rain-sodden ground. As Matt turned Pips toward the meadow, he heard the shoes of the peddler's horses ringing on paving stones. The sound jerked him upright. That road had not been paved since... He pulled the gelding back around. The canvas-topped wagon was rolling over level gray paving stones that stretched just the width of the village. The peddler himself, a rotund fellow in a wide hat, was peering at the pavement and shaking his head, peering at the village and shaking his head. Peddlers followed fixed routes. He must have been this way 100 times. He had to know. The peddler halted his team and tied the reins to the brake handle. Matt cupped both hands around his mouth.
"Keep going, man!" he shouted at the top of his lungs. "As fast as you can! Keep going!"
The peddler glanced in his direction and hopped up on his seat, quite spryly for such a stout man. Gesturing as grandly as Luca, he began to declaim. Matt could not make out the words, but he knew what they would be. News of the world that he had picked up along the way, interspersed with lists of his goods and claims for their vast superiority. Nobody in the village stopped to listen or even paused.
"Keep going!" Matt bellowed. "They're dead! Keep going!"
Behind him, somebody gasped. Tuon or Salusha, maybe both. Suddenly, the peddler's horses screamed, tossing their heads madly. They screamed like animals beyond the ragged edge of terror and kept screaming. Pips jerked in fear, and Matt had his hands full. The gelding danced in circles, wanting to run, in any direction so long as it was away from here. Every horse belonging to the show heard those screams and began whinnying fearfully. The lions and bears began roaring, and the leopards joined in. That set some of the show's horses to screaming, too, and rearing in their harnesses. The tumult built on itself in moments. As Matt swung round, struggling to control Pips, everyone he could see handling reins was fighting to keep a wild-eyed team from racing off or injuring themselves. Tuon's mare was dancing too, and Salusha's done. He had a moment of fear for Tuon, but she seemed to be handling Achaean as well as she had in her race into the forest. Even Salusha seemed sure of her seat, if not of her mount. He caught glimpses of the peddler as well, pulling off his hat, peering toward the show. At last, Matt got Pips under control, blowing hard as if he had been run too hard for too long, but no longer trying to race away. It was too late. Likely, it had always been too late. Hat in hand, the round peddler leaped down to see what was the matter with his horses. Landing, he lurched awkwardly and looked down toward his feet. His hat fell from his hand, landing on the hard-packed road. That was when he began screaming. The paving stones were gone, and he was ankle-deep in the road, just like his shrieking horses. Ankle-deep and sinking into rock-hard clay, as if into a bog, just like his horses and his wagon. And the village, houses and people, melting slowly into the ground. The people never stopped what they were doing. Women walked along carrying baskets, a line of men carried a large timber on their shoulders, children darted about, the fellow at the grindstone continued sharpening his hatchet, all of them nearly knee-deep in the ground by this time. Tuon caught Matt's coat from one side, Salusha from the other. That was the first he realized he had moved Pips, toward the peddler. Light.
"What do you think you can do?" Tuon demanded fiercely.
"Nothing," he replied. His bow was done, the horn knocks fitted, the linen bowstrings braided and waxed, but he had not fitted one arrow to its ash shaft yet, and with all the rain they had been having, the glue holding the goose feather fletchings was still tacky. That was all he could think of, the mercy of an arrow in the peddler's heart before he was pulled under completely. Would the man die, or was he being carried to wherever those dead Shiotans were going? That was what had caught him about those buildings. That was how country people had built in Shiota for near enough 300 years. He could not tear his eyes away. The sinking peddler shrieked loudly enough to be heard over the screaming of his team.
"Help me!"
he cried, waving his arms. He seemed to be looking straight at Matt.
"Help me!"
over and over. Matt kept waiting for him to die, hoping for him to die. Surely that was better than the other, but the man kept on screaming as he sank to his waist, to his chest. Desperately, he tipped back his head like a man being pulled under water, sucking for one last breath. Then his head vanished, and just his arms remained, frantically waving until they too were gone. Only his hat, lying on the road, said there had ever been a man there. When the last of the thatched rooftops and tall chimneys melted away, Matt let out a long breath. Where the village had been was another meadow decked out in cat daisies and jump-ups, where red and yellow butterflies fluttered from blossom to blossom. So peaceful. He wished he could believe the peddler was dead. Except for the few that had followed Luca into the meadow, the show's wagons stood strung out along the road, and everybody was down on the ground. Women comforting crying children, men trying to quiet trembling horses, everyone talking fearfully and loudly to be heard over the bears and the lions and the leopards. Well, everyone except the three Aes Sedai. They glided hurriedly up the road, Jolene heeled by Blerick and Fenn. By their expressions, Aes Sedai and warders alike, you might have thought villages sinking into the ground were as common as house cats. Pausing beside the peddler's wide hat, the three of them stared down at it. Teslin picked it up and turned it over in her hands, then let it drop. Moving into the meadow where the village had stood, the sisters walked about talking, peering at this and that as if they could learn something from wildflowers and grasses. None had taken the time to don a cloak, but for once Matt could not find it in him to upbraid them. They might have channeled, but if so, they did not use enough of the power to make the fox head turn chilly. He would not have taken them to task if they had. Not today. Not after what he had just seen. The arguing started right away. No one wanted to cross that patch of hard-packed clay that seemingly had been paved with stone. They shouted over one another, including the horse handlers and the seamstresses, all telling Luca what had to be done, and right now. Some wanted to turn back far enough to find a country road and use those narrower ways to find their way to Lugard. Others were for forgetting Lugard altogether, for striking out for Ilion by those country roads, or even going all the way back to Abu Dhar and beyond. There was always Amadisia and Terabon, Giladon too, for that matter. Plenty of towns and cities there, and far from this shadow-cursed spot. Matt sat Pips's saddle, idly playing with his reins, and held his peace through all the shouting and arm-waving. The gelding gave a shiver now and then, but he was no longer attempting to bolt. Tom came striding through the crowd and laid a hand on Pips's neck. Julin and Amethera were close behind, she clinging to him and eyeing the show folk fearfully, and then Noel and Ulver. The boy looked as though he would have liked to cling to someone for comfort, to anyone, but he was old enough not to want it seen if he did. Noel appeared troubled too, shaking his head and muttering under his breath. He kept peering up the road toward the Aes Sedai. Doubtless by that night he would be claiming to have seen something very like this before, only on a much grander scale.
"I think we'll be going on alone from here," Tom said quietly.
Julin nodded grimly.
"If we must," Matt replied.
Small parties would stand out for those who were hunting for Tuon, for the kidnapped heir to the Shan Chan Empire, else he would have left the show long since. Making their way to safety without the show to hide in would be much more dangerous, but it could be done. What he could not do was turn these people's minds. One glance into any of those frightened faces told him he did not have enough gold for that. There might not have been enough gold in the world. Luca listened in silence, a bright red cloak wrapped around him, until most of the show folk's energy was spent. When their shouts began to trickle away, he flung back the cloak and walked among them. There were no grand gestures now. Here he clapped a man on the shoulder, there peered earnestly into a woman's eyes. The country roads? They would be half mud, more streams than roads, from the spring rains. It would take twice as long to reach Lugard that way, three times, maybe longer. Matt almost choked to hear Luca invoke speed, but the man was hardly warming up. He talked of the labor of freeing wagons that bogged down, made his listeners all but see themselves straining to help the teams pull them through mud, nearly hub-deep on the wagon wheels. Not even a country road would get that bad, but he made them see it. At least he made Matt see it. Towns of any size would be few and far between along those back roads, the villages tiny for the most part. Few places to perform, and food for so many hard to come by. He said that while smiling sadly at a little girl of six or so, who was peering up at him from the shelter of her mother's skirts. And you just knew he was envisioning her hungry and crying for food. More than one woman pulled her children close around her. As for Amadisia and Terabon, and yes, Giladon, they would be fine places to perform. Valenluca's grand traveling wonder show and display of marvels would visit those lands and draw immense crowds. One day. To reach any of them now, they must first return to Abu Dhar, covering the same ground they had crossed these past weeks, passing the same towns where people were unlikely to lay out coin to see again what they had seen so short a time before. A long way, with everyone's purses growing lighter and their bellies tighter by the day. Or they could press on to Lugard. Here his voice began to take on energy. He gestured, but simply. He still moved among them, but stepping more quickly. Lugard was a grand city. Abu Dhar was a shadow beside Lugard. Lugard truly was one of the great cities, so populous they might perform there all spring and always have new crowds. Matt had never been to Lugard, but he had heard it was half a ruin, with a king who could not afford to keep the streets clean, yet Luca made it sound akin to Camelin. Surely some of these people had seen the place, but they listened with rapt faces as he described palaces that made the Terrasen Palace in Ebu Dar seem a hovel, talked of the silk-clad nobles by the score who would come to see them perform, or even commission private performances. Surely King Rurdron would want such? Had any of them ever performed before a king before? They would. They would. From Lugard to Camelin, a city that made Lugard look like an imitation of a city. Camelin, one of the largest and wealthiest cities in the world, where they might perform the whole summer to never-ending throngs.
"I should like to see these cities," Tuan said, moving Akain nearer to Pips. "Will you show them to me, Toy?"
Seleucia kept the dun at Tuan's hip. The woman looked composed enough, but doubtless she was shaken by what she had seen.
"Lugard, maybe. From there I can find a way to send you back to Ebu Dar."
With a well-guarded merchant's train and as many reliable bodyguards as he could hire. Tuan might be as capable and dangerous as Aginan made out, but two women alone would be seen as easy prey by too many and not just brigands.
Maybe Camelin.
He might need more time than from here to Lugard, after all.
"We shall see what we shall see," Tuan replied cryptically,
then began exchanging finger wriggles with Seleucia. "Talking about me behind my back, only doing it right under my nose. He hated it when they did that."
"Luca's as good as a gleeman, Tom, but I don't think he's going to sway them."
Tom snorted derisively and knuckled his long white mustaches.
"He's not bad, I'll grant him that, but he's no gleeman. Still, he's caught them, I'd say. A wager on it, my boy? Say, 1 gold crown?
Matt surprised himself by laughing. He had been sure he would not be able to laugh again until he could rid his head of the image of that peddler sinking into the road, and the horses. He could almost hear them screaming still, loudly enough that it came near to drowning out the dice.
"You want a wager with me? Very well, done."
"I wouldn't play at dice with you," Tom said dryly, "but I know a man turning a crowd's head with words when I see it. I've done as much myself."
Finishing with Camelin, Luca gathered himself with a spark of his usual grandiosity. The man strutted.
"And from there," he announced, "to Tarvalen itself. I will hire ships to carry us all."
Matt did choke at that. Luca would hire ships? Luca, who was tight enough to render mice for tallow?
"Such crowds will come in Tarvalen that we could spend the rest of our lives in that vast city's splendor, where Ogier-built shops seem like palaces and palaces are beyond description. Rulers seeing Tarvalen for the first time weep that their cities are villages and their own palaces no more than peasants' huts. The White Tower itself is in Tarvalen, remember? The greatest structure in the world. The Amarlin Seat herself will ask us to perform before her. We have given shelter to 3 Aes Sedai in need. Who can believe they will do other than speak for us with the Amarlin Seat?"
Matt looked over his shoulder and found the 3 sisters no longer wandering about the meadow where the village had vanished. Instead, they stood side by side in the road, watching him, perfect images of Aes Sedai serenity. No, they were not watching him, he realized. They were studying Tuan. The 3 had agreed not to bother her anymore, and being Aes Sedai were bound by that. But how far did an Aes Sedai's word ever go? They found ways around the oath against lying all the time. So Tuan would not get to see Camelin, and perhaps not Lugard. Chances were, there would be Aes Sedai in both cities. What easier for Jolene and the others than to inform those Aes Sedai that Tuan was a Shan Chan High Lady? In all likelihood, Tuan would be on her way to Tarvalen before he could blink. As a guest, of course, to help stop the fighting. No doubt many would say that would be for the good, that he should hand her over himself and tell them who she really was. But he had given his word. He began to calculate how near to Lugard he dared wait before finding her passage back to Ebu Dar. Luca had had a difficult time making Tarvalen sound greater than Camelin after his spiel on that city, and if they ever reached Tarvalen, some might actually be disappointed comparing his mad descriptions. The White Tower 1,000 paces high? Ogier-built palaces the size of small mountains? He claimed there was an Ogier steading actually inside the city. But finally he called for a show of hands in favor of pressing on. Every hand shot up, even the children's hands, and they had no vote. Matt pulled a purse from his coat pocket and handed over an Ebudari crown. I never enjoyed losing more, Tom. Well, he never enjoyed losing, but in this instance it was better than winning. Tom accepted with a small bow.
I think I'll keep this as a memento, he said, rolling the fat gold coin across the back of his fingers. To remind me that even the luckiest man in the world can lose.
For all the show of hands, there was a shadow of reluctance to cross that patch of road ahead. After Luca got his wagon back onto the road, he sat staring, with Littell clinging to his arm as hard as Amathera ever clung to Julin. Finally, he muttered something that might have been an oath and whipped his team up with the reins. By the time they reached the fatal stretch, they were at a gallop, and Luca kept them there until well beyond where the paving stones had been. It was the same with every wagon. A pause, waiting until the wagon ahead was clear, then a flailing of reins and a hard gallop. Matt himself drew a deep breath before heeling Pips forward. At a walk, not a gallop, but it was hard not to dig his heels in, especially when passing the peddler's hat. Tuon's dark face and Seleucia's pale displayed no more emotion than Aes Sedai's faces did.
I will see Tarvalin one day, Tuon said calmly in the middle of that. I shall probably make it my capital. I shall have you show me the city, Toy. You have been there.
Light. She was a tough little woman, gorgeous but definitely tough as nails. After slowing from his gallop, Luca set the pace at a fast walk, rather than the show's usual amble. The sun slid lower and they passed several roadside meadows sufficiently large to hold the show, but Luca pressed on until their shadows stretched long ahead of them, and the sun was a fat red ball on the horizon. Even then he sat holding the reins and peering at a grassy expanse beside the road.
"It's just a field," he said at last,
too loudly, and turned his team toward it. Matt accompanied Tuon and Seleucia to the purple wagon once the horses had been handed over to Metwin, but there was to be no meal or games of stones with her that night.
"This is a night for prayer," she told him before going in with her maid. "Do you know nothing, Toy? The dead walking is a sign that Tarmangaiden is near."
He did not take this for one of her superstitions. After all, he had thought something very like that himself. He was not much for praying, yet he offered a small one then and there. Sometimes there was nothing else to do. No one wanted to sleep, so lamps burned late throughout the camp. No one wanted to be alone, either. Matt ate by himself in his tent, with little appetite, and the dice in his head sounding louder than ever. But Tom came to play stones just as he finished, and Noel soon after. Lopin and Nerim popped in every few minutes, bowing and inquiring whether Matt or the others wanted anything, but once they fetched wine and cups, Lopin carried the tall pottery jar and broke the wax seal. Nerim carried the cups on a wooden tray. Matt told them to find Harnan and the other soldiers.
"I don't doubt they're getting drunk, which seems a good notion to me," he said. "That's an order. You tell them I said to share."
Lopin bowed gravely over his round belly.
"I have assisted the file leader now and again by procuring a few items for him, my lord. I expect he will be generous with the brandy. Come along, Nerim. Lord Matt wants us to get drunk, and you are getting drunk with me if I have to sit on you and pour brandy down your throat."
The abstemious Karienin's narrow face grew pinched with disapproval, but he bowed and followed the tyrant out with alacrity. Matt did not think Lopin would need to sit on the man, not tonight. Julin came with Amathera and Ulver, so games of snakes and foxes, played sprawled on the groundcloth, were added to stones played at the small table. Amathera proved an adequate player at stones, unsurprising given that she had been a ruler once, but her mouth became even more pouty when she and Ulver lost at snakes and foxes, although nobody ever won that game. Then again, Matt suspected she had not been a very good ruler. Whoever was not playing sat on the cot. Matt watched the games when it was his turn there, as did Julin, if Amathera was playing. He seldom took his eyes from her, except when it was his turn at a game. Noel nattered on with his stories, but then he spun those tales even while playing, and talking seemed to have no effect on his skill at stones. And Tom sat reading the letter Matt had brought him, what seemed a very long time ago. The page was heavily creased from being carried in Tom's coat pocket, and much smudged from being read and reread. He had said it was from a dead woman. It was a surprise when Doman and Aginen ducked through the entry flaps. They had not precisely been avoiding Matt since he moved out of the green wagon, but neither had they gone out of their way to seek him out. Like everyone else, they were in better clothes than they had worn for disguises in the beginning. Aginen's divided skirts and high-collared coat, both of blue wool and embroidered in a yellow near to gold on the hem and cuffs, had something of a uniform about them, while Doman, in a well-cut brown coat and baggy trousers stuffed into turned-down boots just below his knees, looked every inch the prosperous, if not exactly wealthy, Ilioner merchant. As soon as Aginen entered, Amathera, who was on the groundcloth with Ulver, curled herself into a ball on her knees. Jewel inside and got up from the stool across the table from Matt, but Aginen reached the other woman first.
"There's no need for that, with me or anyone else," she drawled, bending to take Amathera by the shoulders and draw her to her feet. Amathera rose slowly, hesitantly, and kept her eyes down until Aginen put a hand beneath her chin and raised her head gently. "You look me in the eyes. You look everyone in the eyes." The Terrabonner woman touched her tongue to her lips nervously, but she did keep looking straight at Aginen's face when the hand was removed from her chin. On the other hand, her eyes were very wide.
"This is a change," Julin said suspiciously, and with a touch of anger. He stood stiff as a statue carved from dark wood. He disliked any Seanchan for what they had done to Amathera. "You've called me a thief for freeing her." There was more than a touch of anger in that. He hated thieves, and smugglers, which Doman was.
"All things change, given time," Doman said jovially, smiling to head off more heated words. "Why, you do be looking at an honest man, Master Thief-Catcher. Lylwyn did make me promise to give up smuggling before she would agree to marry me. Fortune prick me, who did ever hear of a woman refusing to marry a man unless he did give up a lucrative trade?"
He laughed as though that were the funniest joke in the world. Aginen fisted him in the ribs, hard enough to change his laughter to a grunt. Married to her, his ribs must be a mass of bruises.
"I expect you to keep that promise, Bale. I am changing, and so must you."
Eyeing Amathera briefly, perhaps to make sure she was still obeying, Aginen was big on others doing as she told them. She stuck out a hand toward Julin.
"I am changing, Master Sandar. Will you?"
Julin hesitated, then clasped her hand.
"I'll make a try at it," he sounded doubtful. "An honest try is all I ask."
Frowning around the tent, she shook her head.
"I've seen Orlop decks less crowded than this. We have some decent wine in our wagon, Master Sandar. Will you and your lady join us in a cup or two?"
Again, Julin hesitated.
"He has this game all but won," he said finally. "No point in playing it out."
Clapping his conical red hat on his head, he adjusted his dark, flaring Tyran coat unnecessarily and offered his arm to Amathera formally. She clasped it tightly, and though her eyes were still on Aginen's face, she trembled visibly.
"I expect Ulver will want to stay here and play his game, but my lady and I will be pleased to share wine with you and your husband, Mistress Shipless."
There was a hint of challenge in his gaze. It was clear that to him, Aginen had further to go to prove she no longer saw Amathera as stolen property. Aginen nodded as if she understood perfectly.
"The light shine on you tonight, and for as many days and nights as we have remaining," she said by way of farewell to those staying.
Cheerful of her. No sooner had the four departed than thunder boomed overhead. Another loud peal and rain began pattering on the tent roof, quickly growing to a downpour that drummed the green-striped canvas. Unless Julin and the others had run, they would do their drinking wet. Noel settled on the other side of the red cloth from Ulver and took up Amathera's part of the game, rolling the dice for the snakes and the foxes. The black discs that now represented Ulver and him were nearly to the edge of the web-marked cloth, but it was evident to any eye that they would not make it. To any eye but Ulver's, at least. He groaned loudly when a pale disk, inked with a wavy line, a snake, touched his piece, and again when a disk marked with a triangle touched Noel's. Noel took up the tale he had left off when Aginan and Doman appeared, as well as a story of some supposed voyage on a seafolk raker.
"Arthur and Mier, women, are the most graceful in the world," he said, moving the black disks back to the circle in the center of the board. "Even more so than Damani. And you know, that's saying something. And when they're out of sight of land..."
He cut off abruptly and cleared his throat, eyeing Alvar, who was stacking the snakes and foxes on the board's corners.
"What do they do then?" Alvar asked.
"Why..."
Noel rubbed his nose with a gnarled finger.
"Why, they scramble about the rigging so nimbly, you'd think they had hands where their feet should be. That's what they do."
Oliver oohed, and Noel gave a soft sigh of relief. Matt began removing the black and white stones from the board on the table, placing them in two carved wooden boxes. The dice in his head bounced and rattled, even when the thunder was loudest.
"Another game, Tom?"
The white-haired man looked up from his letter.
"I think not, Matt. My mind's in a maze tonight."
"If you don't mind my asking, Tom, why do you read that letter the way you do? I mean, sometimes your face looks like you're trying to puzzle out what it means."
Ulver yelped with glee at a good toss of the dice.
"That's because I am, in a way. Here."
He held out the letter, but Matt shook his head.
"It's no business of mine, Tom. It's your letter, and I'm no good with puzzles."
"Oh, it's your business, too. Moraine wrote it just before... Well, anyway, she wrote it."
Matt stared at him for a long moment before taking the creased page, and when his eyes fell on the smudged ink, he blinked. Small, precise writing covered the sheet, but it began, "My dearest Tom." Who would have thought Moraine, of all people, would address old Tom Marilyn so?
"Tom, this is personal. I don't think I should..."
"Read," Tom cut in. "You'll see."
Matt drew a deep breath. A letter from a dead-eye Sedai that was a puzzle and concerned him in some way? Suddenly he wanted nothing less than to read the thing. But he began anyway. It was near enough to make his hair stand on end. "My dearest Tom, there are many words I would like to write to you, words from my heart, but I have put this off because I knew that I must, and now there is little time. There are many things I cannot tell you lest I bring disaster, but what I can, I will. Heed carefully what I say. In a short while, I will go down to the docks, and there I will confront Lanfear. How can I know that? That secret belongs to others. Suffice it that I know, and let that foreknowledge stand as proof for the rest of what I say. When you receive this, you will be told that I am dead. All will believe that. I am not dead, and it may be that I shall live to my appointed years. It also may be that you and Matt Cawthon and another, a man I do not know, will try to rescue me. May, I say, because it may be that you will not or cannot, or because Matt may refuse. He does not hold me in the affection you seem to, and he has his reasons which he no doubt thinks are good. If you try, it must be only you and Matt and one other. More will mean death for all. Fewer will mean death for all. Even if you come only with Matt and one other, death also may come. I have seen you try and die, one or two or all three. I have seen myself die in the attempt. I have seen all of us live and die as captives. Should you decide to make the attempt anyway, young Matt knows the way to find me. Yet you must not show him this letter until he asks about it. That is of the utmost importance. He must know nothing that is in this letter until he asks. Events must play out in certain ways, whatever the costs. If you see Lan again, tell him that all of this is for the best. His destiny follows a different path from mine. I wish him all happiness with Nynaeve. A final point. Remember what you know about the game of snakes and foxes.
Remember and heed. It is time, and I must do what must be done. May the light illumine you and give you joy, my dearest Tom, whether or not we ever see one another again. Moraine.
Thunder boomed as he finished. Fitting that. Shaking his head, he handed the letter back.
Tom, he said gently, Lan's bond to her was broken. It takes death to do that. He said she was dead.
And her letter says everyone would believe that. She knew, Matt. She knew it all in advance.
That's as may be, but Moraine and Lanfear went into that door-frame Tirongrial, and it melted. The thing was redstone, or looked to be stone, Tom, yet it melted like wax. I saw it. She went to wherever the Aelfin are, and even if she is alive, there's no way for us to get there anymore.
The Tower of Genji, Ulver piped up, and all three adults turned their heads to stare at him.
Birgitta told me, he said defensively. The Tower of Genji is the way to the lands of the Aelfin and the Eelfin.
He made the gesture that began a game of snakes and foxes, a triangle drawn in the air, and then a wavy line through it.
She knows even more stories than you, Master Charon.
That wouldn't be Birgitta's silver bow, would it?
Noel said wryly. The boy gave him a level look.
I'm not an infant, Master Charon. But she is very good with a bow, so maybe she is. Birgitta born again, I mean.
I don't think there's any chance of that, Matt said. I've talked with her too, you know, and the last thing she wants is to be any kind of hero.
He kept his promises, and Birgitta's secrets were safe with him.
In any case, knowing about this tower doesn't help much unless she told you where it is.
Ulver shook his head sadly, and Matt bent to ruffle his hair.
Not your fault, boy. Without you, we wouldn't even know it exists.
That did not seem to help much. Ulver stared at the red cloth game board dejectedly.
The Tower of Genji,
Noel said, sitting up cross-legged and tugging his coat straight.
Not many know that tale anymore. Jane always said he'd go looking for it one day. Somewhere along the Shadow Coast, he said.
That's still a lot of ground to search. Matt fitted the lid on one of the boxes. It could take years.
Years they did not have if Tuon was right, and he was sure that she was. Tom shook his head.
She says you know, Matt. Matt knows the way to find me. I doubt very much she'd have written that on a whim.
Well, I can't help what she says, now can I? I never heard of any Tower of Genji until tonight.
A pity,
Noel sighed.
I'd have liked to have seen it. Something Jane Bloody Farstrider never did. You might as well give over,
he added when Tom opened his mouth.
He wouldn't forget seeing it, and even if he never heard the name, he'd have to think of it when he heard of a strange tower that lets people into other lands. The thing gleams like burnished steel, I'm told. 200 feet high and 40 thick, and there's not an opening to be found in it. Who could forget seeing that?
Matt went very still. His black scarf felt too tight against his hanging scar. The scar itself suddenly felt fresh and hot. It was hard for him to draw breath.
If there's no opening, how do we get in? Tom wanted to know.
Noel shrugged, but Ulver spoke up once more.
Birgitta says you make the sign on the side of it anywhere with a bronze knife.
He made the sign that started the game.
She says it has to be a bronze knife. Make the sign, and a door opens.
What else did she tell you about?
Tom began, then cut off with a frown.
What ails you, Matt? You look about to sick up.
What ailed him was his memory and not the other men's memories for once. Those had been stuffed into him to fill holes in his own memories, which they did and more, or so it seemed. He certainly remembered many more days than he had lived. But whole stretches of his own life were lost to him, and others were like moth-riddled blankets or shadowy and dim. He had only spotty memories of fleeing Shadowlogoth, and very vague recollections of escaping on Doman's river ship. But one thing seen on that voyage stood out. A tower shining like burnished steel. Sick up. His stomach wanted to empty itself.
I think I know where that tower is, Tom. Rather, Doman knows. But I can't go with you. The Eelfin will know I'm coming. Maybe the Eelfin, too. Burn me, they might already know about this letter because I read it. They might know every word we've said. You can't trust them. They'll take advantage if they can. And if they know you're coming, they'll be planning to do just that. They'll skin you and make harnesses for themselves from your hide. His memories of them were all his own, but they were more than enough to support the judgment. They stared at him as if he were mad, even Ulver. There was nothing for it but to tell them about his encounters with the Eelfin and the Eelfin. As much as was needful, at least. Not about his answers from the Eelfin, certainly, or his two gifts from the Eelfin. But the other men's memories were necessary to explain what he had reasoned out about the Eelfin and Eelfin, having links to him now. And the pale leather harnesses the Eelfin wore? Those seemed important. And how they had tried to kill him, that was very important. He had said he wanted to leave, and failed to say alive, so they took him outside and hanged him. He even removed the scarf to show his scar for extra weight, and he seldom let anybody see that. The three of them listened in silence, Tom and Noel intently, Ulver's mouth slowly dropping open in wonder. The rain beating on the tent roof was the only sound aside from his voice. "That all has to stay inside this tent," he finished. "Aes Sedai have enough reasons already to want to put their hands on me. If they find out about those memories, I'll never be free of them." Would he ever be entirely free of them? He was beginning to think not. Yet there was no reason to give them fresh reasons to meddle in his life.
"Are you any relation to Jane?"
Noel raised his hands in a placating gesture.
"Peace, man, I believe you. It's just that tops anything I ever did. Anything Jane ever did, too. Would you mind if I made the third? I can be handy in tight spots, you know."
"Burn me, did everything I say pass in one ear and out the other? They'll know I'm coming. They may already know everything."
"And it doesn't matter," Tom put in. "Not to me. I'll go by myself if necessary. But if I read this correctly," he began folding the letter up almost tenderly, "the only hope of success is if you are one of the three."
He sat there on the cot, silent now, looking Matt in the eye. Matt wanted to look away and could not. Bloody Aes Sedai. The woman almost certainly was dead, and yet she still tried coercing him into being a hero. Well, heroes got patted on the head and pushed out of the way until the next time a hero was needed, if they survived being a hero in the first place. Very often heroes did not. He had never really trusted Moiraine, or liked her either. Only fools trusted Aes Sedai. But then, if not for her, he would be back in the Two Rivers, mucking out the barn and tending his Da's cows. Or he would be dead. And there old Tom sat, saying nothing, just staring at him. That was the rub. He liked Tom. Oh, blood and bloody ashes. "Burn me for a fool," he muttered. "I'll go." Thunder crashed deafeningly right atop a flash of lightning so bright it shone through the tent canvas. When the rumbling booms faded, there was dead silence in his head. The last set of dice had stopped. He could have wept.